Sometimes in life, we find ourselves at a crossroad. In the case of Josh Lloyd, he had to make a decision between following the money or taking the path less traveled.
About the middle of my sophomore year, my GPA wasn't that great. I was still going. I had to make a decision of, is this what I want to do for the rest of my life, or do I see my career going somewhere else? And that was probably, in my life, the hardest conversation I think I've ever had to have with anybody. And that was to go back and sit down with my dad, who's, not the easiest person to talk to at times, to say, hey, listen, I can't do this anymore. Like, I got to concentrate on school. I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but I'm going to concentrate on school and finish and get my degree. It was tough. I was 19 years old, but I also knew, I looked at my dad in the car business, my entire family, my cousins, my uncles, and I just sort of fast-forwarded a little bit, and I was like, I'm pretty sure this isn't where I want to be. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had actually no idea what I wanted to do, but I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss building a foundation for solid work ethic, staying curious, and making the impossible possible. And now, episode 7 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we have the technology trailblazer, Josh Lloyd. Josh is the co-founder and CTO of Fitmetrics, which provides state-of-the-art technology to gyms and health clubs to give members the ability to schedule, train, and receive real-time tracking of effort and performance through a facility's website or customizable app. Fitmetrics has partnered with hundreds of gyms across the nation, including Lifetime Fitness, Gold's Gym, Cycle Bar, Cooper Institute, US Fitness, and more. Prior to co-founding Fitmetrics, Josh was the co-founder and visionary of Shop Visible, which provided business owners with smart technology that combined solutions for customer service, back-office inventory, marketing, accounting, and IT into one SEO-friendly tool. Due to the success of Shop Visible, Josh was ranked as one of Atlanta Business Leader's top 25 entrepreneurs in Atlanta in 2012. Prior to Shop Visible, Josh was the director of research and development for CareMedic Systems, as well as Omega Systems. Josh has a bachelor's degree in business from Florida Atlantic University and has 20 years of experience in professional software development. With that being said, I would like to welcome my friend Josh Lloyd to the show. Josh, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Great. So for those that may not know about you, kind of your journey, Fitmetrics, all that you've done, can you kind of give them a brief overview about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I've been in technology for about 20 years now. My background's pretty diverse. Before getting into technology, I actually worked with my dad pretty closely when I was a kid selling cars. And I think sort of bridging those two things together had a big impact on my life and really where I've come from and where I've gotten to.
Okay, so now where did you grow up?
So I grew up in South Florida. I was born in Miami, still a big Dolphins fan. Got to see them win this weekend, so it was pretty exciting.
Oh, boy, here we go. We won't judge you for that. We won't judge you for that.
The new dome was beautiful and more beautiful in the end.
Oh, man, horrible. So you grew up in South Florida, predominantly Miami. Okay, great. Now growing up down there, how were you as a kid? Were you into sports? Were you into technology? Were you just kind of curious? What was your your upbringing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So when I was a kid, I loved being outside. So playing basketball, playing football, going water skiing. I lived, pretty close to the water, so I had good access to that. Was always pretty athletic. Started working out when I was a kid, probably around 13 years old. And that was a lot of fun. And, at the time I grew up, really went from the Atari 2600 through the Nintendo through the Sega Genesis. My first computer was a Commodore 64, so that's kind of my timing, and that's where I learned a little bit of technology and that kind of thing.
Okay, what was your favorite gaming system at this point?
So it's pretty funny. I on the Commodore 64, I quickly learned how to make the screen change colors. I was pretty excited, and I got a little book that taught me how to do the Summer Olympics. I think it was in 1984 for the Los Angeles Olympics. And it was writing basic code, and I didn't really know what the heck I was doing. I was just writing whatever the book said. And then I realized this is actually pretty cool stuff.
So you already had an itch at a very young age for technology and just that curiosity.
Mostly a curiosity. Used to love playing video games back in the day, and you know, never really realized what it would mean later on in life, obviously. But yeah, for sure, I definitely always had a knack for it.
Okay, but at this point, you know, you didn't really think about future. You're a young kid. You're just thinking, I want to try some cool stuff, play some games, and have some fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the computer in particular, you know, we used to walk around with the 5 1/4 inch floppy disks. And
wow, throwback.
Yeah, way back in the day. And so I used to have those and trade them with my buddies, and we would copy programs that we probably shouldn't have been doing. And you know, so it was a lot of fun to kind of learn how that all worked then.
I think as skilled as I ever got was maybe Oregon Trail.
It's pretty good.
It's a solid game. They should bring it back.
There were some good ones. Mortal Kombat, the original version, was fantastic.
Was the original on floppy?
No, I don't remember. I had a Kung Fu game on floppy on my Commodore. I don't know if it was Mortal Kombat. I think it predated that a little bit.
Okay. So, you know, you're growing up, video games, sports, so you're pretty balanced in that regard. Pretty much anything that kind of challenged you, it sounded like you were into.
Yeah, absolutely. I was... you know, when I was 12 or 13 years old, I used to do sailing competitions, water skiing competitions, because we lived on the water. So that was a ton of fun. And then my dad actually sold his business and in Miami, and we moved up about 40 miles away to Delray Beach, which, you know, at that age is a pretty massive change. Scenery, new friends, new everything.
Quite different. And back then, Delray was not what Delray is today.
Oh, absolutely. Delray... when I first went over there, every single person was over 75 except for us. And it was farm fields, and I was like, I don't understand what my parents did there, but it worked out well in the end.
So now the company that your dad sold at that point was in the auto business?
It was, yeah.
Okay, so you grew up watching him grow that business, do sales. Did you go into work with him?
Oh yeah, definitely. So when I was a kid, my dad, just to give a little bit of background, he started his business with my grandfather. So this is going way back in the day. My grandfather's a retired police officer, and he moved down from Boston, where most of my dad's family's from. And he rented a gas station in a pretty bad neighborhood in the middle of Miami. And my dad was a kid, started hustling cars with my grandfather at this gas station, and started doing really well with it, and eventually bought the gas station, and then eventually bought the property adjacent to that and the one adjacent to that and so forth. So over a period of about 20 years, his car lot expanded from 93rd to 95th Street, and it was one block deep. So he had about 600 cars on the lot, insurance company, maintenance shop, paint and body shop, buy here, pay here financing. They were moving about 500 cars a month through his business.
Those are serious auto numbers, by the way.
Yeah.
500 a month.
Yeah, he was doing great. I mean, he was basically effectively a CarMax before there was such a thing.
Okay. So growing up in that environment, do you feel like that was your first taste of entrepreneurship?
Yeah. I mean, so at that time, you know, I was young. So my dad over the summer was like, great, you're going to come to the office with me. And I didn't sell anything. Instead, he put me in the paint and body shop, which was fantastic because nobody spoke English. And they just said, here, wear a mask and sand down the cars. By the end of the summer, I actually painted my own car, which was pretty, pretty interesting. So I think more than anything else, that had a pretty profound impact on me in the sense that work ethic-wise, I just realized I enjoyed working. I enjoyed seeing something start from nothing and kind of a finished result. The selling portion kind of came a little bit later when we moved up to Delray, and we'll get into that a little bit, I'm guessing.
Okay, nice. So you grow up down in South Florida. You now make the move to Delray. Are you in high school at this point, middle school?
10th grade.
Okay, 10th grade. And how was it moving from Miami to now Delray, but in the middle, were you in the middle of your high school year at this point?
I was. There was a girl that I really liked a lot, and I didn't want to tell her I was moving, and I ran into her the day before I was leaving, so that was kind of funny. But yeah, it was a pretty massive transition. I mean, I went from growing up since kindergarten with all the same friends, and then literally cut off, went up to Delray and had to remake, you know, all my friends with 2 years ago with a bunch of kids that have also known each other since kindergarten.
So when you made the move, you know, how did you feel? Was it one of these things where you kind of used it as fuel to kind of reinvent yourself or to get submerged into a craft or a hobby per se? Or did you kind of get discouraged by it? You know, different people, I always talk about this because certain moments in our life kind of dictate our future. And you don't realize in that moment how little of a deal actually it transpires to be much, much bigger, and how you kind of react based off of that.
Yeah, it's so a couple of interesting things happened. So firstly, I moved up. I'll talk about school, and then I'm going to talk about personal life really quickly. So I moved up there, and the school that I went to is actually in Boca Raton, and it was much closer than the school I was supposed to go to. So unfortunately, I didn't have the right address to go to the school I was going to. So I used my cousin's address to go to the school that I went to. And that had a whole sort of chain of events that occurred. You know, so firstly, I didn't know anyone. I had to make a whole bunch of friends. And a bunch of the friends that I made, at the end of the year, great news, they opened a second school because there were too many kids. And all the friends I made had left and went to the other school. So I had to start over again the next year, which was super interesting. But my dad, who's, you know, a pretty big inspiration to me and an entrepreneur in his own right, certainly, he was like, listen, after getting up at 6:30 in the morning two or three times, he's like, I'm good. I'm not driving you to school anymore. So here's a car. I was 14. He's like, just drive to school and drive home. So I did. Drove to school and drove home to taking the bus because I couldn't.
That's a lot of faith.
He had a lot of trust in me. It's a big part of, I think, what kind of gave me the freedom to do a lot of the things that I do today. So we did that. The main reason we moved from Miami to Delray was because my dad, about 2 years prior to selling his company, had actually gotten into flying. And so he really got his, you know, within a short amount of time, he got his pilot's license, and he got his twin engine pilot's license, even got his helicopter license. And a friend of his had turned him on to an area in West Delray that was actually a private airstrip. So it was a grass runway at about, I think, maybe 30 or 40 houses, if I remember correctly. Road went down the middle, taxiway behind one set of houses, and the road and the runway behind the other set of the houses. And when we moved up, we rented a house, and he built a house up there. And the house we built actually was smaller than the hangar to hold the airplane behind the house. So if you can imagine just having a gigantic garage. So we had a plane in the backyard. And I started to learn to fly when I was about 14. At the same time all that other stuff was going on.
So while most 14-year-olds are going to comic book stores or playing soccer on the street with their friends, you're driving cars and flying planes.
I was, yeah.
Were your friends like, I want your dad as my dad at this point?
Yeah, my dad was definitely a popular dad.
So I'm curious, do you feel like he was who he was because of his father? It kind of trickled down, or was he different from his father in that regard? Because it's a pretty cool thing, right, to have a dad that is that entrepreneurial, that's that innovative, and it kind of, you get to be part of that, and he almost encourages you to kind of be that way.
Yeah, it's the, you know, he and his dad are very different from each other personality-wise, but I do think their relationship was very different than my relationship with my dad, but I think their relationship caused my dad to be much more involved and much more open with me. And so, you know, and at the end of the day, he was, you know, I was getting good grades. He's like, all right, cool, go do what you want to do, and you know, just do what you're supposed to do. And I did. I was a he likes to say I was a pod child, but I did all the things I was supposed to do, and you know, I got a lot of benefit out of that.
Do you feel like because he gave you a little bit more freedom, it allowed you to be more creative and allowed you to be a little bit more curious versus some kids growing up, they grew up in very strict households and almost are kind of restricted from using their skills and talents?
Definitely. I mean, I didn't, you know, you don't know what you know, 20, you know, looking back years and years ago now, I think that even with my own kids now, I try to give them enough rope to kind of make good decisions, but I can pull them back in if they don't. And I think it's really, really important to let kids have some level of flexibility to figure out who they are and what they want to do. And, you know, ultimately, you know, they all get it right, and if they're loved and have good mentoring. But yeah, I mean, I absolutely would not be who I was today or who I am today if it wasn't for the freedoms I had.
Nice. So you get into flying at this point, you're 14 years old, and you start flying. Do you have a pilot license at this point? Are you going through training at this point? Is your dad just letting you fly while he watches? Kind of what's the process as you get into this?
Yeah, it's a good question. So legally speaking, you have to be, I'm trying to remember back now, 17 years old to get your pilot's license, 16 years old to solo the airplane. So, but you can start flying when you're a little kid. I mean, you can fly whenever you want. You can jump in the left seat of a plane and just hit the go button, basically. So I, my dad taught me how to fly, you know, so after school I would go up with him and we'd cruise around and we would go flying. And then eventually, at some point, maybe prior to 16, I was at Boca Airport, which is just, it was, you know, a 2 minute flight from where the house was. And, my dad's like, hey, I'm getting thirsty. I'm going to get out and take a soda. And he's like, go fly the plane around a couple times by yourself and come back and pick me up. And I was like, all right, let's go ahead and do it. And so it was the most, I think probably even through today, amazingly freeing feelings I think you can ever have. I you know, taxied the plane to the end of the runway. I got on the runway, wasn't really thinking much about it. You know, like whenever you're trained in doing something, you do it repetitively enough times. You're like, whatever, you know what to do, and you go through it. It wasn't until I put the power in, took the plane down the runway, and I was in the air, and I looked over next to me and realized there was absolutely nobody next to me. So the only way this plane was going back on the ground was if I made the plane go back on the ground. It was a pretty amazing feeling.
So there was no fear?
No fear. I remember just a big smile. I remember a pretty big sense of jubilation. I remember when I landed a gigantic sense of relief as well.
So, you know, we'll kind of bring this kind of full circle here. So when you're growing up, video games, computers, technology are kind of something that sparks your interest. Is this your new kind of wave of innovation and technology, this new passion of flying?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, at that point, really, you're going to school, so you're mired down with all the things related to high school. And then just sort of getting to go home and doing something that's so unique that no one else is doing, and getting to learn to fly. And also, I mean, this is in the early 90s, so over this period of time between then and now, the technology in aviation has just, you know, exploded, really. And so getting to kind of understand how all of that worked was super interesting. And over that period of time, just so many different interesting flying stories that I got to experience. But, you know, my dad was who he was. So we had an airplane and it was due for the annual inspection. Every airplane has to get inspected annually. And so he, instead of taking it to the shop, he had a good couple friends of his that were aviation mechanics. They actually came to the house and did the inspection then. And I got to participate in that. It was pretty amazing. Take the airplane kind of apart and put it back together and see what that was all about. It was something that was super cool.
So what were you do say from that experience were the greatest lessons you learned? What were your biggest takeaways from the aviation experiences? Because I know you still fly to this day, right?
I do. I fly a lot.
Okay. I hate flying, by the way.
Awesome. Come fly with me. You'll feel better.
See, it's very scary. If it's a jet, I can make it happen. But if it's a small plane, I just have the craziest fear of flying.
So the plane that I fly today, most of the time is called a Cirrus.
Okay.
And a Cirrus, they have a couple different models, but regardless of the model, and they have a jet now, it just came out, it has a parachute. I don't mean like I wear a parachute. I mean the entire plane has a parachute.
Okay, that makes me feel a little better.
Yeah, so if, God forbid, the engine shut off, you just reach up, pull the handle, and parachute comes out immediately, lands the plane, lands it at 5 miles an hour, even if you're spinning.
That's comforting.
Yeah.
Okay. So from the aviation aspect, what do you think are the greatest lessons that you learned from that?
You know, so looking back at it now and, you know, over the last few years thinking about it, and my own kids pretty interested in flying, and, you know, my older son in particular, and, you know, how hard he works at his schoolwork and sort of his day-to-day of that. And then thinking back, you know, I got good grades in school and all that, but the time that I took to go and get my pilot's license, it was a lot. Like when it was time to get my pilot's license, there's a big difference between, oh, cool, I know how to start the plane and go up and fly it, and all right, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to get my pilot's license and I'm going to sit in front of a FAA certified examiner who is going to basically grill you. There's an oral test that lasts about 2 hours. Makes this podcast seem relatively easy. I would hope so. Thank you. And you know, so you have this guy, and then you do a written test afterwards, and then you do your flying test. It's in three parts. So, you know, being 17 years old, having to study, go through all of that, and pass that test, it really, like, looking back at it, with all the work I had on my plate at the time, getting ready for college, making sure my grades in high school were great, my you know, dating, social life, all of that stuff, And then, oh, by the way, throw this other thing on top of it. It's really kind of amazing if you put your mind to something you want to do, what you can get accomplished. And I actually, right on the heels of getting my pilot's license, I, within the next 12 months, got my twin engine pilot's license, my seaplane license, which is pretty awesome, so you can land in the water, and my instrument rating. That, to this day, was the hardest test I've ever taken.
The instrument rating?
The instrument rating.
So what was so hard about it?
You know, the written test was no joke. I mean, it was a lot of hours of studying. My dad would like to tell you that I didn't study that hard. I studied my butt off. I barely passed it. It was very, very hard. And then the pilot's test, when I actually went out and took my instrument flying test, I actually failed it the first time. I had to go back and do it again. And I think those little things in life, it was like, you know, you're a kid, so you got to like dust yourself off and like, all right, I failed that thing. I got to do it again. Even my own son, my younger son, is an amazing athlete. He didn't make the basketball team this year. We were just talking about this morning, and I'm like, sometimes it's those failures in life. How do you respond to them and go back and deal with it? And I had all this other stuff going on, but I knew I wanted to get my instrument rating, and I, you know, I sucked it up. I went back. I did the test the second time. I passed the test. I was very happy. I think it was probably more rewarding because of it.
You know, when you look at a lot of the most successful people in sports, business, whatever it may be, they all have either one big failure or multiple failures. I mean, talk about basketball. Look at Jordan, right?
Absolutely. The biggest one they always talk about.
The biggest one they always talk about. And I think a lot of people are destined to do great things or have the opportunity to, but it's easier to just say, I quit. It's too hard. I don't want to put in the work. I mean, pilot license, for example. How many hours? I mean, it's quite a bit of hours you need to fly, correct?
Yeah, by the time – so to get your private pilot license, I'm trying to remember back. Probably you can do it with the testing and everything in about 50 to 60 hours. That's just flight time on top of the book time and the, you know, and all the other things you need to do. Your instrument rating is probably another 100 hours on top of that. So wow. It's a significant investment in time.
But yet, you know, you always hear people say, I don't have time. There's exactly. Not enough time. And I think that's such bullshit because – if you want to make time, you'll make it. There's 24 hours in the day. And when you really break it down and look at it, there's more time than people even understand.
So I'm a big and this is something not from when I was a kid really, but definitely much more in my adult life, probably my 20s. I started to realize exactly what you just said. I think that if you are motivated to get something done, you can get something done. I don't think people realize how much time they spend watching TV or how much time they really just spend on their phone doing, well, pretty much nothing. And not to suggest I don't. I mean, I'm guilty of all of those things as well. but I think that get up a couple hours earlier in the morning and make it happen. And that's whether you're looking in the mirror not happy with the way you look or you want to change your life for the better. Put the investment into yourself. I mean, the two things I think of right off the top, one is somebody once told me, you know, why would I invest in someone else before I invest in myself? I think you have to invest in yourself. And if that means you got to put in more time, If I'm a huge sports guy. I love sports. And I always love the quotes in the newspaper and training camp during the NFL season when people are like, so-and-so is always the first one to arrive at camp and the last one to leave. That's pretty interesting because they say that about everybody. But as an aside, it's true. Like the guys that put in the time, they're the ones that do the best. I mean, look at Peyton Manning, look at Tom Brady. I mean, Michael Jordan, all these guys that were the most amazing in their field, they put in the time. So when you're in the business world, no one remembers back to be like, oh, that guy got up early in the morning and he was the last one to leave the office at night or whatever it is. But if you really believe in what you're doing, you've got to invest in yourself.
No, I mean, I completely agree. You know, bring up Tom Brady, right? I'm not a Brady fan. I'm a Jets fan.
I'm a Dolphins fan. I'm in the same boat. And so, I'm not happy with the
and
Jets.
And we're not either. Happy with you either. But we're in the same boat when it comes to Brady. But the one thing I will say about Brady is I respect the man. Because a lot of people say he's the greatest, he's this, he's that. But you know what? He still works like he has nothing. No accolades, no accomplishments. And they never settle. I think that's the difference between being great and being, you know, a legend pretty much in your space.
Absolutely. I mean, Tom Brady's he's my age and he wants to play till he's in his mid to late 40s, and I as much as I hate that as a Dolphins fan, I hope he does. I mean, it sends a serious message about if you read anything about it, I think he started his own business now around nutrition.
He did, yeah.
And you know, how you have to take care of yourself to accomplish these things. And, you know, like I said, everyone at the end of the day has to, you know, you look in the mirror, you figure out what you want to achieve in your life, and you go for it.
So let's just talk about your routine quickly, because you have a successful business, you have kids, you work out, you have all these things going on. What does your day typically look like?
So my Monday looks a lot different than my Saturday. So I'll start with the Mondays, because like everyone else, you wake up Monday morning and you want to close your eyes and put the cover back on and not deal with Monday. So Monday, I typically get up around 6 in the morning, maybe a little bit before. By the time Friday rolls around, I'm getting up without an alarm clock about 4 in the morning. So usually what I'll do is I take that opportunity between about 4 a.m. and 6:30 a.m. really to catch up and get myself ahead for the day or whatever those things are going to be. So whether that's propelling the company forward, whether it's just stuff going on in my personal life and making sure I'm situated for where my kids need to be. And then some of that's just for me as well. You know, in a lot of ways, I'm still the same person I was when I was playing video games when I was a kid. I'm passionate about it. I get those couple hours in front of the computer just to get done what I need to get done. At that point, kids got to get ready. You know, kids are woken up. Lunches are made. The kids are, you know, out the door to school. I go to the gym. Always. I try to work out 5 days a week if I can. And, you know, then I'm in the office and, you know, go through my normal routine in the office. I think one of the most important things and one of the reasons I get up early in the morning is I will not sacrifice the time with my family. So I think that as much as it's critical to have an amazing work ethic and work on what you believe in and work out and take care of your physical body and your mental state, I also think it's probably more critical to make sure you're spending the time with your family and listen to what's going on in their lives and be as supportive as possible to those things and just be present, phones away, and have those couple of hours, you know, with the kids and really deal with that. And then, you know, after that, it's usually, unless there's some sort of work crisis, a little bit of just veg time. And then I usually during the week, I'm in bed by 10.
Okay. So it's interesting, you know, most people, entrepreneurs specifically, talk about balance, hard to get balance. Yet the more I speak to people that have become successful and earlier on in their career was all about business, going, the older they get, the more they start to shift their thought process, and family kind of becomes number one, and you prioritize around that. So a lot of people say, I don't have time, or I can't balance family, work, life. It's the same thing as you just said. You have to make the time.
You got to make the time. I mean, people tell me routinely, Josh must never sleep. I sleep amazing. I close my eyes. I'm out like a light. I wake up. I go. You know, everyone operates on a different number of hours of sleep, but I always get at least 6 hours of sleep every night of the week, no matter what.
And that's the thing. I mean, 6 hours is a lot of sleep. I mean, so most people are sitting here thinking that you can't do all this, but yet you've just tackled working out, kids, family, work, your time, and you still got 6 hours of sleep.
I did. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So now you, flying is going great. You graduate high school. Next step is college. You elect to go to, I believe it was FAU, right?
It was, yeah.
Okay. Now, how did you end up selecting Florida Atlantic?
So it wasn't my first choice, but one thing that happened in sort of that in-between stage when I was in high school, and this is probably the thing that made me who I am today. I would say it definitely is the thing that made me who I am today. So my dad was retired for about a year and a half, and he decided he was bored. Which, you know, happens. He was young, by the way. He sold his business at 40 years old, which is pretty remarkable.
That's great, yeah.
And so his whole life he had spent in a pretty bad neighborhood selling pretty bad cars to folks that needed financing. And he's like, hey, you know what? I've got this basically giant garage in the backyard. Why don't I just go to the auction, buy a couple of nice cars, put some ads in the newspaper, and sell them? Remember, there's no real internet at the time.
Yeah.
So I was about 14, 15 when this happened. And so he did that. And, you know, to know my dad and to know that he doesn't do anything sort of half ass, you know, within 3 months, we had 12 cars in the hangar around an airplane and multiple ads in the paper. And we were selling cars. And so I was about that age. That's when I really started selling. And okay. I really started to realize I had a pretty big passion for selling stuff. And so I would come home after school. I would hustle cars. I'd hustle cars on the weekend. and I was making a pretty good living. And so by the time I hit my senior year of high school, my grades were really good. I applied to essentially every school in Florida. So I applied to I knew I was going to stay in Florida, so I applied to UF and FSU, Miami, and FAU were the schools I applied to. I got into all of the schools, and I went and decided to stay at FAU, mostly because I had a bit of a business with my dad, and so I tried to balance this idea that I could do that and go to college. I will say it didn't work out well at the beginning. So,
in which regard, for the sales side or for the school side?
No, the school side for sure, because I was making good money. I was enjoying it. But the time that was starting to take up relative to my ability to go to school and concentrate and go to classes, you know, at that age, didn't go well. I actually had a scholarship, which I subsequently didn't have after the end of my freshman year. So about the middle of my sophomore year, you know, my GPA wasn't that great. I was still, you know, still going. I had to make a decision of, is this what I want to do for the rest of my life, or do I see my career going somewhere else? And that was probably, in my life, the hardest conversation I think I've ever had to have with anybody. And that was to go back and sit down with my dad, who's, you know, not the easiest person to talk to at times, to say, hey, listen, I can't do this anymore. Like, I got to concentrate on school. I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but I'm going to concentrate on school and finish and get my degree.
That's a pretty mature decision for a young person to make, in the sense that if you're making that good money at a young age, I don't know a lot of people that would say, I'm going to give up the money and I'm going to focus on my education.
It was tough. I was 19 years old, but I also knew, you know, I looked at my dad in the car business, my entire family, my cousins, my uncles, and I just sort of fast forwarded a little bit, and I was like, I'm pretty sure this isn't where I want to be. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had actually no idea what I wanted to do, but I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do.
So do you, you know, that's actually a pretty interesting thing, right? So as a lesson, do you feel like if people focused more, not so much on trying to figure out what they want to do, but instead looking at what they don't want to do, they would make better decisions?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, I think at the end of the day, I mean, how many people, you probably could say the same as me, that graduated with a degree in a certain whatever it was, and they do completely something differently than what they were going to graduate with. I think at the end of the day, is you have to try different things, and you have to figure out if you like them or not, and you'll develop a passion, and you'll see as we kind of go through the rest of this, like FitMetrics, you know, I'm so unbelievably blessed to how that company started and getting to mix a lot of my passions and in my life. But yeah, at the time it was super interesting. So I had that conversation with my dad and my mom, and I went back to just focusing my attention to school. I got a job actually at the local town center mall in Boca, and like a normal teenager. And I actually was valet parking cars.
You know, I worked at town center mall.
Oh, you did?
I did. When I used to come home during holiday breaks. So my family lives in Boca. I think I worked at Banana Republic.
Good for you.
Yeah, I did like these month stints here and there. It was nice.
I was outside of Fridays, and I can't remember the seafood place.
McCormick and Schmitz.
Yeah, right there, and I was valet parking cars, and super interesting. You know, this is, looking back again now, probably another one of those moments of entrepreneurship, because I realized, you know, it was great exercise. I loved it. I'm running outside. I got to do my schoolwork when it was slow. It was really a fantastic job. Probably, you know, as a kid, I'd recommend valet parking cars to anyone who can drive a stick shift. It's a great job. It's a lot of fun. But it was interesting, I started counting the revenue. And I'm like, wait a minute, there's a lot of money being made here. And I was like, well, if you could scale this out into multiple places, then that's like a pretty serious business. And I never did anything with it, but I started to realize then just how my brain was wired, you know? Learn something, if you really enjoy it, there's probably a business opportunity, you know, that you could potentially capitalize on.
So you were always looking at things from a strategic standpoint.
Absolutely.
So now you decide you're going to stop selling cars with your dad. You're going to continue your education. What do you kind of continue in from the collegiate standpoint?
So I was going to get a business degree no matter what. I knew that was in my DNA. It was just going to get a bachelor's in business. And so this will be kind of fun. About 1994, I think it was, I was in class with a good friend of mine, and I asked him what degree he was getting. He's like, you know, they have this new program in the business department called MIS, or Management Information Systems. And I was like, well, you know, what is that? How is that different than computer science? I'm not really a programmer. I'm not a computer science kind of guy. Of course, I was very wrong about that. But, you know, how does it differ? And he's like, well, it's less about the programming. It's more about managing systems and making helping companies make decisions, and database management, and a little bit of programming as well. And I'm like, well, that's pretty cool. I didn't even own a computer at the time, by the way, which
really?
Is super interesting. Yeah. So I bought my first computer and started doing – I took a class. It was a very basic Microsoft Access Excel kind of class. Did very well in it. Took a C programming course that next semester. And I hadn't really committed that that's what I was going to do. I was just taking, you know, credits within my business degree. And I really realized I liked it a lot. Like, it was a ton of fun. I was very good at it. And then I was like, all right, I'm just going to go all in, and I'm gonna get that degree. Now, what's kind of interesting is about my junior year, my senior year of college, I started to get the itch to sell cars again, because it was something I was pretty good at. And so I worked with a very good friend of my dad's, who we used to buy cars from, and he was willing to let me use his dealer license, and most importantly, his money. That was an important part.
That's key. That's key.
And I could go to the auctions and buy cars and sell them. And so if you took what I was doing earlier on and kind of fast forward, I actually, with my dad, we rented a hangar at the Boca Raton Airport, which was literally, as you probably know, about a minute and a half drive from FAU's campus. And I had about 8 cars in the hangar. I had ads in the Auto Trader, on the Sun Sentinel, the local newspaper. I had a cell phone. I'm not sure what people thought of me while I was back in the 90s doing that. But I would go between classes, and I would sell cars. And I was selling about 10 cars a month between my junior and senior year out of the hangar, doing really well. Finally got my degree. And then I said, all right, I'm cutting cold. I got a job making about 50% of what I was making, but in my degree, so I could get really practical experience.
So now you graduate. You've been in the year, like you said, in this industry 20 plus years, right? And you've worked a wide array of industries. I think everything from public sector, healthcare, retail, e-commerce, and obviously most recently Fitmetrics in the fitness space. So what was this first company kind of, what was the journey before you kind of hit your big situation? So I think it started with, was it SunGard?
Yeah, so SunGard bought a company that I worked for, and it was called UCS. It was a small company out of Fort Lauderdale, and they got bought subsequently by a company called HTE, and then eventually SunGard. The week I went there, I think they went public the week before.
Wow.
And it was, so I came at kind of an interesting time, and you know, it was my first job out of college. So you have no idea how you are relative to anybody else in your office, but you're there and you're working. And they put me on a project and I did it. And, you know, maybe a year later, it turns out that project had failed twice before they gave it to me. And so I did pretty well with it. They moved me into another team, which was a new product that they were building. And I did the development there as well. And I really, really loved what I was doing. I was very passionate about it. I worked, you know, a lot of hours, you know, your first job out of school, just trying to prove it both to yourself, but also to your peers and to your bosses. And something interesting happened about a year into that job, which was that as I really gained confidence and understood what I was doing, people started recommending, hey, you should talk to Josh about this project you're working on outside of my job. And I, you know, went and would have a conversation. I'm like, yeah, I can help you with that. And, you know, you'd help someone with that. And you're making, you know, a couple dollars here and a couple dollars there. Well, all of a sudden, those couple dollars here and there started to become really big dollars. And then I realized that I was actually sort of thwarting my own potential by having a full-time job where I was. So that was my first time really in my professional life saying, I'm going to go out and hang my own shingle and do this. And so I did. And I did consulting and sort of software project kind of stuff for the next couple of years. And that grew a lot. And it grew into my next job, which was a consulting gig I picked up for a company called Omega Health Systems, which built software for helping hospitals bill, effectively get, you know, collect their funds. And the eventuality of that was that Omega actually acquired my, if you will, consulting practice, because I had 3 or 4 guys that actually I had built up to working for me. So We came on full time. I took over the development team, and that company eventually sold to a larger company called CareMedic Systems, which I worked at for about a year and a half. And that was the first time that I realized, probably in my life, it was about 2004, 2005, I realized that I don't think I want to work for anybody anymore. I realized that I'm much more passionate sort of starting something, building it, seeing what that is. And it's just sort of in my DNA, and it's something that was, you know, really was what motivated me.
Yeah. So, you know, it sounds like most people would have been excited, like, I'm getting acquired, I'm getting picked up, people are coming, and they would just been content with that in some regard, or like, hey, I did a great job. For you, it was like, it was good, but it taught you what you wanted more versus what you didn't want. And you didn't want that red tape. You wanted that flexibility to go out and do yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my boss, well, I guess my boss's boss at CareMedic is a woman named Sheila Schweitzer, is one of the most brilliant women that I've ever worked with. You know, I really respected a lot of what she was able to do and her career. But, you know, and I learned a ton from her. But at the same time, you know, you start getting into this large 300, 400, 500 person company, and you start looking at the layers of tape and bureaucracy underneath of it to get stuff done. And you know, at the end of the day, my whole life, I've always sort of been a get shit done kind of person. It's just who I am. And, you know, it was extraordinarily frustrating for me on a personal level. I was like, no, I can't do that anymore.
So after you decide to kind of go out on your own, after kind of going this path and this journey, what's kind of the next thing? Is it HR brands now kind of coming to play at this point?
So not quite yet. So what happened was, you know, and I do believe in life, working your butt off is definitely important. I also believe there's a lot of luck too. And so had a couple of pretty cool lucky breaks along the way. So one of the things that happened to me while I was in that sort of healthcare time frame in my life was that I had met a couple different companies. One was a startup who asked me to participate in that company, and another was an established mail order catalog company that were really struggling on the e-commerce side of things. They wanted to grow an e-commerce business. They didn't want to necessarily be paying tons and tons of money to search agencies for paid search advertising. They wanted to get really sort of natural search placement. And so I said, hey, you know, I can do that. And at the time, you know, if you're thinking about it, this is early 2000s, you pretty much had two choices, IBM or a Yahoo store. There was nothing in between. There was no Magento. There was no Shopify. There was
WooCommerce. None of this existed.
None of it existed. So I basically, at the time, I built what was effectively Josh's e-commerce platform in my in my room in my house, you know, on the side. It was just sort of a side project. I knew these guys through relationships, and I was building it. But I built a single platform, supported both of these guys, and watched their businesses grow. And in particular, I learned how to work with Google, particularly Google in the search optimization. So the guys that were the mail order catalog company at the time, if you had Google bar equipment, bar supplies, restaurant equipment, restaurant supplies, the other guys were in the TV space. So if you Google things like plasma TV or LCD TV, we were coming up basically page one, top three for every one of those keywords.
Wow.
And, you know, we were doing better than Best Buy. We were doing better than anyone in the restaurant business. I realized I had figured out some interesting stuff. One was how to, well, sell stuff online. And two was how to really do very well. While being an e-commerce company on Google, it's very hard to do that from a search positions perspective.
So when you took on these two projects, were there any doubts in your mind? Were you hesitant, or you were just super confident, or were you just kind of like, weren't even thinking about it because you were excited just to try something new?
I was, you know, that's how I'm wired. So there was a couple things. One, I was super excited because, like, this is fun.
Yeah.
And it was, again, it's like a big video game for me in my head. I'm like, I love it. It's something new. Like, I want to build it. I want to see it succeed. I'll push as hard as I can to see it succeed. I got very lucky. I met a guy here in town in Atlanta named Brian Kajowski, who's one of the co-founders of a company called 360i. My very good friend in South Florida introduced us at lunch down there, and because I still lived down there at the time. And Brian and I started to talk about what eventually became ShopVisible. And, you know, here's the opportunity. And he was working with a lot of large retailers. He saw the opportunity as well. He was coming off the tail end of his business. He was just about to sell it. I didn't realize that when we had met. And he was kind of like anyone else. He was tired, you know, going through, you know, dealing with customers and accounts and managing all of this day-to-day stuff. And so the idea of you know, starting something anew for him was a little bit like, I'm not sure. But for me, I was very passionate about it. I wanted to do it. So we agreed, get started. He came up with the name, actually, walking down in the Virginia Highlands down the street. He's like, what do you think of the name Shop Visible? I'm like, seems pretty appropriate. You know, visibility in the search engines and buying stuff online.
Yeah.
So kind of fast forward. Got hooked up with a company that was here in Atlanta also. And they, a guy that worked there had a product that could, this is going to be pretty funny, who it had a solution that could kill lice and scabies and bed bugs.
Okay.
That was my first Shop Visible customer. Now, the good news is we got page one positions for killing lice, scabies, and bed bugs.
Is the lice bed bug game a big industry?
I'm not sure how big it is, but it definitely was big enough to get us going.
Got it.
So we got going, and we got that client. And, you know, speaking about kind of fear, adversity, right around that time, you know, I actually ended up inadvertently losing all of the source code because I had a computer hardware crash and I didn't have the latest code backed up. And that would have been one of those moments in life that was sort of like game over.
Yeah.
And, you know, I realized that through some luck and some persistence and some magic over the next few days, I was able to kind of get that back and get it righted and we were able to proceed forward. But that was a pretty scary moment in my life.
Wow.
As you can imagine. But the funny thing was, about a year and a half later, you know, the company's growing. I moved to Atlanta at this point. We went up to Kentucky and met with the team at Tempur-Pedic through a relationship who said they were looking to replatform their e-commerce business. And we went in there and I demoed, of all sites, LiceScabiesAndBedBugs.com.
Well, they are on beds.
They are on beds.
It's a nice tie-in.
It was somewhat appropriate. I always like to try to bring some level of levity into the sales process. they saw the connection. They thought it was very funny. I honestly, to this day, say we had absolutely no business winning that account. But we were the young upstart. They loved the platform, and they gave us a shot. And we did well by Tempur-Pedic. They were with us, I think, for 8 years.
Wow.
And you know, subsequently, sort of the dominoes fall after that. We won 3M, Office Depot's business, and some other, you know, fairly large brands over the time of Shop Visible as well. So, and back to your question about RH Brands and talk about making time, another time question, right? Brian, back in 2005, when he and I met, he had also met what now has become one of my very good friends, Jeff Goldblatt, who's a local Atlanta person. He went to Emory, graduated from Emory, and he had this interesting concept. It was not called RH Brands at the time, and he was sitting on this concept, which I'll get into in a second, and he was trying to figure out how do I monetize this thing. Like, I've got this thing, it's pretty interesting, there's a lot of people looking at it, but I have no idea how to make money at it. So Brian Kujawski met Jeff almost at the same time he met me, and he was like, hey, listen, I would like to give you some equity in this thing, which was called RH Brands. If you can help me on the technology side at the same time we get started with Shop Visible, would you be interested in that? And I was like, yeah, you know what? That sounds cool. I think I would be interested in that. So RH Brands, it is more affectionately here in Atlanta, especially known as the rejection hotline. So, you know, if you're aware of, you know, back years ago when, you know, a girl would be at a bar and you ask for her phone number, she'd give you her phone number and you'd call the phone number that she gave you and it would tell you all of the reasons why you just got rejected, including something about flying unicorns and other fun facts.
Nice. A little different from your other ventures.
Very, very different. It gave me a lot of diversity, though. Very consumer focused.
Yeah.
And all about social virality. And so what my role in that was, I had the role of helping to monetize it. Brian brought in advertisers and I had to figure out how do I scale up these phone numbers and put ads on the phone numbers so we can add, sort of monetize them. And then Jeff, through his sort of creative genius, was able to then create concepts outside of just the rejection hotline. I don't remember the exact number of concepts. It was probably well over 100. The one that I will always remember the most was called Outsource Your Friendship to India. And the reason I remember it the most is because Shaquille O'Neal went on Twitter one day and tweeted that Best Buy was giving away $200 gift cards to the first X number of people who called some phone number, which happened to be Outsource Your Friendship to India. And so
– intentionally or by mistake?
Oh, very intentionally.
Okay.
And that did so incredibly well that not only did it take our system down because there was so much call volume, and our system could handle, if I remember correctly, at peak about 2,500 concurrent calls, which was quite a bit.
Wow.
Each call was about a minute, so I don't know that multiple on an hour and so on, but it was a lot of calls. It not only took our system down, but it actually took down the entire exchange up in Boston where that number was hosted. So in other words, if you were on, I think it was maybe 781 area code, it took down the 781 area code.
That's insane.
It was insane, the amount of volume. I think we did somewhere in the neighborhood at peak 70 million calls 1 year across all the concepts.
That is insane.
So, and again, I just, you know, my job in all of that was the easiest. I just had to make sure it didn't break. Most of the time, it didn't break.
I'll tell you, in the case where it breaks or shuts down an area code, you did something right.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all. That was all Jeff. I was very fortunate to be a part of that, and I learned a tremendous amount. So, I was able to do that and Shop Visible sort of at the same time for a long period of time.
So for Shop Visible, you got some big clients now. You've gotten some big names on board. Can you kind of give a little bit of a context of what Shop Visible did in a sense? I know a lot of integration, taking things from all these different mediums, but what made you so special?
So, you know, in the end, Shop Visible started off as an e-commerce platform that was built to kick ass on Google or Bing or whatever the search engine was. In the end, the power of Shop Visible was built out of a complete level of ignorance and being naive, quite honestly. And I think that happens to people in life. Customers like, hey, I need to be able to process orders. Another customer is like, hey, I need you guys to be responsible for managing our inventory. Another customer is like, hey, I need you guys to be able to help me fulfill products from drop shippers. While another one's like, I have a couple different retail stores and I need to be able to route orders to my warehouse or to my retail stores. You start building out all this super complex business logic. And then there's this phrase that got coined about 5 or 6 years ago called omnichannel. And I have to say, I had a giant smile on my face this weekend. Not only did the Dolphins win, but...
yeah, that's the third time we had to throw that in there just so everybody knows.
Yeah. but NCR actually had a giant omnichannel digital ad up at the game, which was pretty cool.
And that is cool.
I showed it to my son. But the omnichannel part of our platform is what I think intrigued people the most. It's the thing that people really, the clients in particular, like, we get it. And so... as we grew our customer base, our customers got more and more complex business requirements. So, you know, building out a team that understood how to deal with that and growing that team and managing it was, you know, difficult, definitely very difficult. The product got infinitely complex. The customer's requirements continued to get infinitely complex. And being able to continue to, you know, to manage that and innovate and come out with new features and functions and grow the business was an amazing, amazing experience for me.
It's interesting because most brands or consumer products or technology or services, you always say you can't be everything to everyone. But in your mind, you actually had a completely different mindset.
We did. I think to some extent, everyone makes mistakes. I think I always define, what do you do in your box? Like, that's what I always describe. Like, what's in your box and what's not in your box. And I think you have to stay very, very true to defining what you believe your box is. Now, that doesn't mean to say that if you start off as something small, that your box has to be small. I think your box can always grow to what you want it to be, but you should be very aware of the ecosystem and the partners in the space and how they can help you grow your business. And I think we made some mistakes in that area, but I will say that the comprehensiveness, and again, I use the word ignorance of, I didn't know that all these other e-commerce platforms that grew up at the same time we did weren't doing inventory management. They weren't doing order management. They weren't doing warehouse and supply chain integrations. I was like, well, hey, wait a minute. You sell a product. Like, it has to get to someone's house. Like, that's got to happen somehow. That whole set of tools really made the platform what it was and made it, you know, very valuable upon exiting the company.
I think ignorance a lot of times is the greatest asset. If you don't know any differently, you have nothing stopping you. And I feel like sometimes when people know restrictions or what others aren't doing or they think it's not possible, they don't even try.
No, definitely. And even today at FitMetrics, the company we started, again, we had a very small box, just like I did at Shop Visible. The company we are today, our box is completely different than what it was. And what we know now and how we scale and grow that business, I think if I look in 2 years in the future, it's going to be different again. But I think it's really just learning and listening. It's all about listening to what your customers are saying. I know everybody says that, and it's easier to say than it is to do. But if you hear the same thing a couple different times, you probably should take a step back and be like, all right, wait a minute. There's probably something there, to and do some research and talk to some folks and say, you know what, that presents an opportunity.
And I think a lot of that, you know, it sounds like you have to be very open and humble to have that mindset. Because a lot of people in nature, especially when you own something, you're defensive, or you don't mean to be, or you say, I hear it, but do you really hear it? Do you actually then take a look at it, evaluate it, and then make the best decision possible? Most, I would say 9 out of 10 people don't do that. And that's what makes that 1% successful in what they do.
You know, I'm not going to lie and say I'm not stubborn, because I am absolutely stubborn. But I think, you know, I'm always one that goes and takes, I try to look back at, okay, was I really right there? Was that really the best decision? If I had to do it over again, would I have done it differently? And everything in life, personal life, and in my professional life. But absolutely, I agree. I think that, you know, a lot of times I deal with vendors that I partner with. You know, a lot of great people, a lot of great companies, but they're sort of like, this is what our product does, this is all it's going to do, and it's this way or it's the highway. And ultimately, you know, what I do, what I'm very, very passionate and skilled about is software as a service, right? Shop Visible is software as a service. The healthcare stuff we did was software as a service, even though it wasn't called that back in the day. And Fitmetrics is definitely software as a service. The last word there is called service. So you have got to listen to the customer's feedback. If a feature that you've built isn't working well, it's going to die. And you've got to be able to change it and innovate it and add to it and so on.
So you end up growing Shop Visible and eventually exiting, correct?
Yep.
And that was in
2014 exited, yeah.
And was that always your plan and goal, was to build it and then eventually sell or exit?
No, you know, I don't know. You know, people ask that question a lot. I think at the time, it was just build it and grow it and get it to a place of being profitable and good things will happen. Kind of like Kevin Costner says, right?
if they build it, it will come.
Yeah, just figure it. You'll figure it out. But I mentioned earlier that I think part things in life are hard work, and part of things in life are just being really, really lucky. And in the case of both Shop Visible and Fitmetrics, I think I was a lot of both. Yeah. And in the case of Shop Visible specifically, having built that part of the platform that day one, I didn't really know we were going to build. At the end of the day, that's the thing that's going to live on in legacy. The brands that use the Shop Visible platform today use that part of the platform. It wasn't necessarily the best idea in the world. And it wasn't that there wasn't competition and other people doing it. It was just do it well and just do it a little bit differently and be thoughtful about it. And, you know, I know there's a huge startup community here in Atlanta, which is something I'm super inspired by and proud to be a part of. I think there's a giant gap between an idea and executing on the idea. So you could have the most amazing idea in the world and poorly execute, it's not going to matter. You can have an average idea. Shop Visible may have been an average idea at the beginning, and execute really, really well, and you're going to have a very successful story to tell. And I think that's what that was.
So now you next venture, you kind of get out of this, and then this is kind of where Fitmetrics all begins, right? So how did this come about?
All right. So this is like, you know, I joke around with Monica, my co-founder, who I'll talk about in a moment, that this is it for me. This is the end of my professional road. I think
it will never end. Yeah. An entrepreneur will never end.
I know. She tells me that too. I'm like, I don't know about that. But this is really sort of a lot of good timing and luck, a lot of passion about something that I have in my personal life, and then getting to take all that and bring technology to it. It's a really sort of cool story, even for me. And when I get a chance to not be in the office, getting sucked into the micro focus of the day to day and get to look back on it. So to tell the story, about 8 months prior to Shop Visible being acquired, I moved into a new house, and I moved next door to a woman named Monica Diota. And I didn't know Monica prior to this. So, you know, I move in and I am at my mailbox. Our mailboxes were right next to each other, and I introduced myself to her, and she asks me what I do, and I tell her a little bit about what I do, and I ask her what she does, and she tells me she's a mergers and acquisitions attorney, but she's retired because she had kids, and she was sort of looking for that next phase of her life and where she was going to take her career. and that she was going to open up an indoor cycling studio here in Atlanta. Now, you got to look at the timing of this is about 4.5 years ago. So about 4.5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago when I met her, but 4.5 years ago, she started down this journey. There was no cycle bar. There was only a handful of flywheels. And she was taking classes at Flywheel. And a lot like, you know, what I was able to do in my early days, kind of being sort of smart, she reverse engineered the Flywheel Buckhead schedule at the time to figure out sort of how much business they were able to accomplish, and saying, there's a pretty substantial business here. And I'm passionate about indoor cycling. I want to do this. And so she started looking for real estate. She started looking at different technologies that were available. And I moved in next door, and she was telling me all of this. And I was like, well, that's pretty cool stuff. Like, what are you trying to do? She's like, well, I really want to put up a leaderboard where people can compete based on points and, have kind of a data-driven experience while they're in the class. But before they ever show up, I need to make sure they can book a class. I need to make sure they can actually say, I want to be on bike number 7. And by the way, if they wear a heart rate monitor, I would really like it if the heart rate data also would show, because the heart rate data is so incredibly accurate, people will have a very well-known sense of how many calories they burn. And that's where the conversation started. And I was like, wow, that's a pretty big, pretty big request. Like, clearly somebody's doing all of this already. And, you know, Monica's like, well, yes and no. There's some different folks in the space that are doing pieces of this, but no one's really brought it all together. And I said, okay, well, this is a cool conversation. I've been working out since I was 13 years old. Monica's been working out since she was a kid. And we both get to do something we're super passionate about. And I get to use technology. I'm like, all right, I'm intrigued. I want to learn more. And so meantime, put a semicolon there for a moment. I'm running a full business with 50 employees and getting my butt kicked every day by customers and trying to figure out how to grow and innovate this business.
But, you want more pain at this point.
Right. It's like, do I want more pain? And, you know, we talked about work-life balance and hours and how am I going to possibly figure this out? And, you know, but it was such an incredibly cool story and idea that I was like, I got to learn more. So in the fitness space, there's a pretty large company called Mindbody, who a lot of people on this podcast will know. They have about 58,000 boutique fitness studios around the world that use their system for billing and scheduling. What they don't do, what I didn't know at the time, was they don't do anything else I just mentioned. And Monica knew she wanted to use Mindbody as her billing system. So through her persistence, she got me in touch with the head of their integrations team. I was able to speak to them, and I was like, all right, this is pretty easy, right? You guys take care of all the heavy lifting. I'm just going to run my data in the class and send out a couple emails like, life is good, right? They're like, no, we don't do any of that stuff. Like, if you want it, we have an API. Use it, don't use it, whatever. We're somewhat interested, somewhat disinterested. So I went back and went to Monica's dining room table, and I said, all right, Monica, here's the deal. None of it exists. If we want it, we're going to have to build everything. And that's what we did. We sat down and we designed it and we built the platform. That was about April of 2014. August of 2014, we had a prototype ready. Through a relationship, we got hooked up with a local gym here up in Suwannee. They put it up into their gym, broadcasting heart rate. We went through a lot of pain, a lot of learning, a lot of stuff not working properly. They wanted to take the system out. We're like, please don't take the system out. I went through a lot of that early on, sort of pain. And we built the stuff. And meantime, again, I'm still at Shop Visible, still doing my thing. And I have to say, I was very fortunate because I didn't know this even over the last few years at the time. But at Shop Visible, one of the things we did was we built custom websites for people. Even though it was a platform, every new implementation was a brand new custom experience. Fitmetrics, at the end of the day for me, besides having to build the platform, just became taking that model that I had learned on how to create design prototypes and building out stuff to get people excited, and then actually, okay, there's some value here. Let's make it actually work behind the scenes. And was able to apply what I had learned in that same model over the last 7 years to Fitmetrics. So I'll fast forward a little bit. September of 2014, we got an offer letter. We knew we were going to sell the company. And so that was super exciting and really exciting times. And then we subsequently closed our deal in December. around January, I told Monica that we needed to go to IHRSA, which IHRSA, I-H-R-S-A, it's spelled a little funny, is the most prominent sort of trade show in the fitness space. So it's on the equivalent of, let's say, NRF in the retail space, which is the largest retail show. And Monica was like, you're crazy. We have like two customers. We're still working on our stuff. Like, we can't go. I'm like, we have to go. So about March of 2015, we went to IHRSA. We, you know, got a booth. To Monica's credit, she's amazing at all the things I'm not really, designing, supporting, and all of these things. And she put this together. We went out to the show. We walked away, and we won a small company at the time that no one had heard of called Cycle Bar. They had one location in Cincinnati. They now have 130 of them.
Grown a little bit, yeah.
Gold's Gym, which a lot of people have heard of. We got to very lucky to get the opportunity to work with those guys. So that was March of 2015. We came back. It was the best decision we could have ever made. And then from there, it's just been sort of a constant gas pedal. It's going as fast as we can to build and sell.
You know, and I just kind of want to, I'm breaking down the numbers in my head as you're saying it. So this kind of brings me back to people saying they don't have time. You literally took something that didn't exist, started it in 2014, early on, built it out, designed it, and had clients like Gold's Gym and Cycle Bar by March of 2015.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, that's a lot to do in a very little bit of time.
While you have a full-time other company that you're fully invested in running on a daily basis.
True. So if anybody says they don't have time, they're full of shit.
You make the best of your day. You just have to be honest with yourself. And I will say, it's not for the faint of heart. And I, looking back, I honestly don't know how the hell I did it. But it happened.
It's because you put your head down.
Yeah.
So now Fitmetrics, give people a little bit of kind of an understanding. You've took all these things together. You know, kind of give them a kind of an overview of why gyms or studios or health clubs would want to use your software.
So there's a couple of different reasons our software is becoming growingly popular in the gym and in the studio space. So the first part of it is that there's been a massive change in the fitness space even since we've been in the last few years. The boutique fitness studios have grown a lot, and they've taken a significant chunk of business away from the big gyms. The big gyms back in the day, their entire philosophy, their entire model was predicated on get somebody hooked on a membership and hope they don't show up. And that was their business model. Well, that's changed dramatically. So the gyms are now saying, how do I engage my members? And not only how do I engage them when they're here, but how do I engage them when they're not here? All of the systems that are in our space when it comes to the member are mostly focused around the back office, billing, collections, HR, payroll, all of that really critical stuff you need to run your business, but much less focused on the member's journey. And how do I ensure that I retain a member? How do I ensure that that member's actually seeing results and they're gonna be like, wow, I'm gonna stay very sticky to the Gold's Gym brand because Gold's Gym is innovating with technology. They care about me as a person and they're helping me through my fitness journey in my life. And so that's really our evolution and our box that we've defined, which is we have an amazing relationship with the different club management systems, and we're able to really help those guys to grow their business by augmenting what they do by doing what we do really well, and then focused on just making sure the member's journey is fun. And that could be, again, in the studio with live leaderboards and gamification. That can be, you know, booking your spot and knowing, cool, Justin's sitting there. I'm probably going to sit on the other side of the room. No, I'm kidding.
they don't want me to dominate them.
Right. You know, understanding all that kind of stuff, having a mobile app, rewards, challenges, leaderboards, just your weight loss journey, your body composition change journey, all of these cool things that make you say, that's why I pay the money and that's why I go to the gym every day.
So it sounds like Shop Visible was almost the kind of the predecessor to give you this skill set, because you took something that started with Shop Visible, which was one service. You, based on consumer demand and customer demand, had to grow it into multiple other service offerings. And Fitmetrics, in a sense, started the same way, like you said, you know, a couple things. And then as you saw where the voids were, filled it in.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And I think we've built a model We've built a model that if we understand a space, and you have to be passionate about it, obviously, that we understand how to do that. I will say that the growth that we've had at FitMetrics has both been a lot of luck, but also, you know, it's due to the fact that I was able to leverage just my own previous experience to sort of bring into the organization. I'll say another thing, and this is just good fortune as well. People love fitness, and hiring people is much, much easier than it was at Shop Visible, because people are just, they hear about it, like, wow, that's just so cool. Like, I want to be a part of changing people's lives and building technology that does that. And the people that we have at both of those companies, but mostly now in particular at FitMetrics, they're inspiring to me. I mean, they work their tails off. They're very passionate about their customers. They're very passionate about what they do. And that's a huge, huge part of it.
So kind of your whole journey from childhood to this point, what's interesting is everybody looks at businesses or products or services at face value. So most people look at gyms or health clubs and say, I want to own that gym, or I want to own that studio, or I want to build out Cycle Bar. But you're asking the questions behind the scenes. What's fueling those studios? What's the technology behind it? How are you getting that to work? How's it all integrating together? You're asking the questions on a much deeper level that most people don't look at, realizing that there's businesses in those areas. So sometimes people are looking so wide instead of looking so much more niche and really looking at so many capabilities.
Yeah. And for me, I said this earlier, it's a giant video game. I don't know another way to describe it than that. And that's still how I am. I'm, you know, I'm a big kid at heart still in a lot of aspects of my life. And I just getting to sort of look at a puzzle and figure out how you put those pieces together in a way that makes sense, that is going to cause demand. And then how do you say, okay, that's cool, it's working. And then say, oh crap, it's really working. How do I scale this?
Like, yeah.
And be ready to scale that business when you hit those certain points, and just staying in front of it. That's the video game.
So now how many clients is FitMetrics up to from a growth standpoint? How many countries? Because I know the expansion, like you said, it happened pretty quickly, but you were ready and you were prepared for scale.
Yeah, so we're in 25 countries, maybe even a little bit more now, which some of them I'm not even sure where they are, which is probably I should have spent more time in geography class in high school. And I'm just kidding. And then some of them, you know, some of them are in very well-known countries: Australia, New Zealand, the UK, Latin America, you know, Mexico, Canada, United States, obviously. And to kind of put it in perspective, between that first client in August of 2014 and let's say August of 2017, I believe we're now in just over about 1,050 locations, something wow. in that neighborhood now.
Congrats, that's amazing.
Thank you.
So, what's next for FitMetrics?
Good question. So we think that, you know, you have to be able to go where the consumer is. If you look at success stories like Peloton and what they're doing at home and specifically in the cycling space, that is an amazing story. And that alone is only part of the story. You have to marry that with that gym aspect. At the end of the day, consumers don't know how to work out by themselves, for the most part. And they need help. And whether that's I like one-on-one training, I like to be in a small group of two or three people, or hey, I want to go take a class with 30 and 40 people because I feed off that energy. Or you want to work out on your own, but you need help to do it. And you don't maybe want to spend the money on a trainer. You need to have technology that kind of is able to touch on all of those different aspects. And so that's what we look at. I think that virtual is a really big deal. I think that blending the gap between virtual and physical and having the technology play a key part of that is where we see our future. I think that as these gyms get better at this, managing the group classes, managing their small group, they're starting to ask hard questions. So one of the things that I'm so excited, coming out of retail for so many years and coming into the fitness space, I was really taken back by the lack of sophistication in some ways in some of the organizations we would deal with. What I'm so excited about now with our own customers and with prospects that we talk to, they have a lot of like very experienced C-level executives. And that means they're starting to ask the hard questions. What does it all mean? Where is the data? What does the data say? how is this driving my revenue, driving my business forward? And I think all of that just basically presents massive opportunity for Fitmetrics and for us, for others, and for the consumer. At the end of the day, as a consumer going to the gym since I was 13 years old, my gym experience today versus then is wildly different than what it was then.
How's your experience different?
It's more engaging. I mean, if you go, so the gym that I work out at, I've been working out at the same gym since I moved here in 2008 to Atlanta. It used to be you'd go on a Saturday morning to the gym at 10:30 in the morning. It's kind of prime time for the week. Even for our software across all the places we are, we have more people running live heart rate, live cycling classes at about 11 a.m. Wow. Eastern time than any other time during the week. And it's a big number. It's a little scary. But the gym experience, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock Saturday morning in 2008, I'd go in the gym, and the gym floor was packed. People are bench pressing. People are lifting dumbbells. People are just wandering around trying to figure out what to do. I go to my gym today. I was there last Saturday. I was there at 10:30. I bet you there were 7 people in the actual open gym floor. Now, that being said, there was about 70 people between 2 classes that were currently running at the same time.
Interesting.
So the way that the model has shifted, I get more bang for my buck by taking a small group or a class. And if I go to a place I really enjoy, I get a really amazing workout and I get to shut my brain off for an hour. And honestly, that's what most people want. And they don't know what to do. I honestly believe you'll see over the next 10 years, we'll see if I'm right, you'll see the gym floors continue to get smaller. There's a lot of boutique fitness studios opening now where they have 2, 3, 4 different rooms with different modalities. And the whole mindset is, hey, pay us X dollars a month. It's unlimited, all you can eat. And today you feel like yoga, do yoga. Tomorrow you feel like cycling. The next day you feel like kickboxing. The next day you feel like a TRX class or a high intensity kind of workout. We have it all. It's in one place. You're paying less money than you would if you went to 5 different places anyway. And your brain shuts off, and we're going to help you get a killer workout. And at the end of the day, you see results if you show up. So yeah. I think it's not the same gym it was, for sure.
So today we've covered a lot. I think you've given a lot of great insight, a lot of good inspiration, and also just kind of, I think your story and journey will help a lot of people kind of navigate their way through. For an entrepreneur, whether it be in technology, fitness, health, wellness, or just in general, what would you say is the biggest takeaway or thing that you would want to leave them with?
So I'll start with something I told somebody about 5 or 6 years ago, and it was more about working out. Someone, you know, walked up to me one day. It was one of my coworkers at Shop Visible, and they said, "Hey, you know, you look great. You work out a lot. You know all this stuff. What would you say? What's the secret? Like, what is it?" And I said, "Honestly, just show up." I said, "If you just show up and go, that's gonna change it." And I thought of it as you were saying that it applies across the board. I don't care what it is in your life. If you want to be a better family person with your kids or your spouse, or just show up. If you want to succeed and you have this idea and you're like, I think it's a good idea, just get up and invest in yourself and invest in the time, and you'll find out quickly if it was worth it. And you know, you'll have an amazing amount of pride. Whether it works, whether it doesn't work, at the end of the day, you know you gave it a shot across all those disciplines. So to me, my thing is just show up.
I think that's a great point. So for anybody that wants to learn more about yourself or Fitmetrics and get more information, how can they do so? Where do they go?
Well, for sure, the Fitmetrics website is fitmetrics.io. I'll thank Monica. She told me the IO is where all the cool kids hang out. I say it's the domain name that no one can spell because it ends with an X and it's not a .com. And then, you know, I'm on LinkedIn, so just look me up, Josh Lloyd, on LinkedIn, and connect with me. I'd be happy to talk to you.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you coming in today. Love speaking with you, man. And I think, you know, Fitmetrics has got some exciting stuff ahead of it. So thank you again for the time today.
Yeah, thanks, Justin, for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks. Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.